What do you say? There really are no words for that. There really aren't. Somebody tries to say, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. People say that to me. There's no language for it. Sorry doesn't do it. I think you should just hug people and mop their floor or something. Toni Morrison. Welcome to the Lost Traveler podcast. I am your ever-loving host, Henry Cameron Allen. And today I have a very special guest, a very new friend. Of course, they're all special. But Kim Hamer is exceptionally special because we have a lot in common. We're both involved in the arts. We are both survivors of caretaking around cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And we will delve deeply into that. And you're my special co-host for the day. So I'm really, really glad to meet you for the first time and welcome.
Well, thank you, Henry. It's so nice to be here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. So you are, you're an HR professional, human resources, for the Metropolitan Museum of Contemporary
Museum of Contemporary Art,
Contemporary Art in LA.
Yes, yes.
Great. See, I'm on the other side of the world over here in Spain. How did you get involved in HR?
Well, it's really funny. I was just telling someone this. My husband and I had moved to Las Vegas. We took our 3-month-old baby with us, much to the consternation of my father. And my grandmother, they did not want me to take the baby. They thought that Art and I could leave, but they wanted to keep the baby.
Where were you living at the time?
We were living in New York State, just Putnam County, about an hour and a half north of New York City.
Okay.
And so we moved to Las Vegas. I was a new mom. I was sort of going crazy. So I landed this job at a company called Wild Oats, which eventually became Whole Foods.
Okay.
I've been working.
Remember
in the
when they were Wild Oats? I do.
Yep, exactly. And I eventually, about 3 months into it, the store manager came to me and said, "Hey, so we have this part-time HR person, and we, the other department managers, think you'd be good at it because you know everybody." So that was the prerequisite to getting my first position in HR. It quickly turned into a full-time position, and then for just 2 stores, and then it turned to a full-time position regional. So I was in charge of Arizona and Southern California.
Wow.
And that's how I fell in love with HR. I love the people part of it. I loved relating to people. I loved, in the early days, I thought I knew how to tell people how to manage. I did not. I knew nothing. But I love that being able to be a sounding board for managers, helping them understand their own style and figure out how to find the courage to manage well.
Yes.
I love the tactical side of it. I'm not a big fan of compliance, but I love putting processes into place so that everyone knows what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. Yes. It makes it, really nice. I actually even love benefits, so there's really not, there's, I like it because I really am a jack of all trades. And so that's what HR provides for me. It's this huge cavernous, we're therapists, we're lawyers,
yeah.
We're confidants, we're best friends, we're confidants, and we're compliance, and we're also medical people. So it's a really great job for me because I get to put on so many hats, and there literally is no day is the same.
Exactly. Well, and I'm sure that your skills as a mom, your skills as a partner, those all play
for sure.
And
for sure.
And HR, you're also a problem solver. And
yes. Yes.
In just researching a little bit about you, it feels like, I've met somebody else who speaks this language, because until you have walked these roads, it is really, really hard for people to quite understand what it means to be a caretaker, especially if you have other responsibilities, especially if you have a career, especially if you have family.
Now, Henry, I'm going to suggest we use the word caregiver.
Beautiful.
And here's why. I used to use caretaker all the time. And someone said to me, caretakers take care of things. Caregivers take care of people.
Sure.
And they give care. And I kind of, I don't know. And so that's the language I've adopted, because I think it really defines more. We do take care of people, but that feels dry to me. Because really what we're doing is we're giving care, right? It's
sure.
from this really deep place. And even if we're being paid to give care, there are plenty of people who are being paid to give care.
Right.
The care that they're expected to give is not about transactional. It is about that caring, that support, that being there for them, including giving them the meds that they need or taking them for a walk.
That's right.
So
that's right. Yeah. Well, and I go back and forth between the two.
Oh, and yes.
Because yeah. I feel like after having had 2 years as a
right.
caregiver for
yep.
my son
yeah.
passed away from brain cancer when he
yeah.
was 13, it was a real milestone for me in my journey. And I feel like I got so much personally out
yes.
of having had that opportunity to walk
yes.
with somebody in their last years, months, days,
yes.
moments, that I took away something very unique and special. And so I do feel like it's not the spirit of it that I'm coming at. It's not
right.
like I'm taking something away from anyone.
Right.
It is what I carry with me, how it changed me as a human being.
I like that.
Throughout the rest of my life. So it's not either or for me. It's been a glorious gift to have been a caregiver.
Right.
And
for sure.
And I want to say up front, I know loss. Mm-hmm. I don't know the loss of a partner. And I'm sorry you had to go through that journey and your kids. How hard it was for me to go through the loss of my child. So,
and it's really funny. That's exactly what I was going to say to you. I don't know the loss of a child.
Yeah.
And I can imagine how heart-wrenching it is. And I know that my imagination does not nearly encompass that kind of pain. And I'm really sorry
that
your son died. Really,
you know,
really sorry.
Cameron, his name is Cameron. And he and I would go out for Vietnamese food or, you know, to our favorite cafe and just chat about everything under the sun. He was a very spiritual person. And we were talking, he was often talking about his journey, and he knew where he was headed every moment.
Right, right.
We didn't hold anything back from him.
Right.
And so we talked openly about death. And he also had a talkie blog, he called it.
Right.
Videos that he posted on YouTube, and there are a couple on Facebook.
Okay.
And he spoke so eloquently about how we are all going to have our time and our way. Every one of us, 8 billion
yep.
on the planet now.
Yep. Yep.
And we're all going to die. And that's the truth. We are all going to shed
yep.
this mortal coil, and we're going to
yep.
move on into a different form, right?
Yeah.
Really all death is changing from one form of energy into another.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we know from mm-hmm. physics.
Right.
So I've stopped believing in death as a thing. And I don't need it. I don't need it in the same way. Tell me about your journey, if you would. First, the horrible realization that something tremendously special was going to be changing.
Right. I like the way you put that. Yeah.
Wasn't the end of something. It was the beginning of something else.
Exactly. Close one door and open another. So, you know, my husband had cancer twice. So the first time, I wasn't scared that he was going to die the first time. It crossed my mind a few times, but I didn't feel, I think when he did a stem cell transplant, so when they do a stem cell transplant, they take your white blood cells out of you, they spin them so they get the very core, the stem cell, the white blood cell, then they dose you with a heck load of chemo to kill the cancer. Then they put the white blood cell back in with the idea that it's supposed to go into the bone marrow and then make more white blood cells. And I think there was a moment when he was doing that, when he was so sick that he couldn't walk, that I was like, oh my gosh, he might die. But for those 7 months, other than those kind of few days, I really didn't think that he was going to die. The cancer came back the second time, and I would like to explore my subconscious mind to figure out what I was thinking, but I do know it came back in January. His birthday was in February. He needed a new wallet. And I remember looking at the wallet and thinking, let's just wait. And I don't remember, that thought happened in a second, went out my head, and didn't occur again till like a year after it, until a year later when it was his birthday and he wasn't around.
Yeah.
And I remember why I didn't, you know, because I remember thinking it was a shock that he was going to die. He was very sick. He started to show signs. He would be confused in the morning. I was having to clean him sometimes in the morning, bathe him. He was getting weaker and weaker. It used to be I would get him up and get the kids up and get, you know, kids would get him dressed and I'd be like, hey, make sure you're getting dressed today. He was having trouble dressing himself in those last, probably the last week that he was alive. And when I went in, they called me from the hospital one day and said he went in to have his chemo done, actually to get fluids, and they kept him because he was running a fever, which was typical. You know, when your white blood cell count is low, you get infections and fevers are very dangerous. So he was running a fever. They decided to keep him. It was a Friday. Saturday, I didn't go up because I was just exhausted. The hospital round trip was an hour and a half on a good day. I live in LA. So a bad day would mean it was going to take me 2 hours, 2 hours and 15 minutes. And I was just tired. So I didn't go up, but I sent a friend up. And the next morning I got a phone call from the hospital and they said, we need permission to draw a spinal fluid. And I said, why aren't you asking him? And they said, well, he seems kind of confused. And they said, well, what is he saying? And he said, well, when I say, you know, can we do this? We say, you know, he says, hello, how are you? And then he says, nice to meet you. And I thought, oh, so I called a friend. I remember being very clear that I could not, whatever was happening with my husband, I was not going to be able to go in there alone.
Yeah.
And I called this friend and he came with me. And my husband was at that point having this kind of brain seizures. And his last words to me, you know, I said, do you know where you are? Because he would kind of come in and out of consciousness or kind of in it. His eyes were always open, but he was kind of coming in and out knowing where he was. And I said, do you know where you are? And he said, yes, I'm going up. I'm going up. Mm. And those were his last words to me. Mm. And then finally, we had our doctor came in on a Monday and said, he's going to die. And because he's young, he's probably not going to die till Thursday. His organs will hold out as long as they possibly can.
He was only 44, right?
He was 44. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So he said, you know, his organs are going to try to hold out for as long as they possibly can. I'm going to say Wednesday, Thursday, the latest. And he died at 1:16 a.m. on Thursday. Wow. Now, the one thing I know about my husband, he's pissed. He was pissed that he did not die on April 15th, which is tax day in the United States, mm-hmm. because he would have loved to have died on a day where it's the two things that we know for sure, death and taxes. He would have. So I know that he's pissed that he didn't get his body to shut down before midnight on the 15th, because that would have made him really happy. And that's the kind of sense of humor that I think about him when I remember him. And, you know, those are the type of things I remember about him.
Yeah, I still, it's been just this past September was the 14-year milestone. I don't like to call them anniversaries. I feel like anniversaries is too light. It's too celebratory.
Yeah.
Milestone is a little bit heavier. And for those of us who have experienced loss, whether it's a beloved child, partner, parent, friend, every birthday is a milestone. Every day of passing is a milestone. Every holiday, you know, we're in the midst of the holiday season. It's a milestone. How do you navigate? Because I have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress around that experience. And I think a lot of surviving caregivers are walking around undiagnosed. How do you
I might be this? One of them.
You might be. We could talk about that. We could talk about what are your triggers around these times and the kids
so, too. You know, it's been really interesting. My relationship with my children is so close. I am having knee surgery on December 5th, knee replacement surgery. And my oldest son is a nurse and he's coming out and he's staying with me for a month.
Oh, right?
And my daughter is here. She lives with me and they went out. He came out recently and they went out for a walk and they were like, you know, mom's going to need a lot of help. And it wasn't, they didn't come to me like, this is what we'd like to do. It was, this is what we're going to do. This is what's going to happen. So you asked how I handle it. I think the one thing I do, I am so grateful for my husband's family and for my family. I don't feel like I get triggered, and I use that word very carefully because I always feel like if it's a trigger, that means that's a sign that's something you need to deal with. It's not a sign, something you need to run away from.
Right.
So I just feel a lot of love. I feel a lot of gratitude. I don't, you know, it's not the expectant holidays that really get me. It's my husband, when we first got together, especially when we first moved to LA, we would hear a lot of sirens, right? A lot of police and fire department. And my thing was, oh my God, someone's in trouble. That's horrible. Like right. I would get fearful. It would hurt my heart. And he would say, oh no, I always look at it like they're going to get someone. Like, I think go get them. So he had this really positive view about it. And so after he died, I would just, you know, see these sirens and I think, go get them guys, go get them. Well, I kid you not. I'm on year 13, I'll be 14 in April.
Okay.
And 4 months ago, fire engine goes by, I pull over on the street, I say, go get them. And I burst out and crying.
Yeah.
Right. Because I remember who taught me that. I remember that he, you know, just that moment of that hole, that the exposed crack, the raw, you know, the scar that's never really healed, right? So I touched that for a moment and it hurt and I cried. I stayed pulled over. I sobbed for a few minutes and then I got on my way. And so it's the little, you know, it's the triggers of, I think our triggers are different because you don't know what your son would, you know, you could only speculate what your son would be like at 20, right? And there's a huge difference between 13 and 20. Like all these things happen at that age.
Yeah, he'd be 28, going on 28 now.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy. And so my speculation is more about what he missed. He didn't get to see his kids. You know, my youngest was 7 when he died. He's now 20, you know, and he's really smart like him. And he's really interested in history like him. And that just pisses me off. Like, it makes me so mad that Art missed this opportunity. He was in the trenches with me when the kids were young, and he didn't get to benefit from being in the trenches, seeing them now. And so those to me are sort of triggers. When I have conversations with my children, particularly with my youngest, who reminds me the most about him, that triggers me. Sometimes I'll get off the phone with him and I just cry because I think, damn it, like you just, honey, you should be here to see him. Like you would enjoy this kid that he's turned out to be. At the same time, he would be a totally different kid if my husband was alive.
A guy wire is a tensioned cable that is designed to enhance the stability of a freestanding structure. Think of me as your guy wire. In terms of life skills mentoring, you're perfectly capable of standing stably on your own 2 feet. But I'm a cable that can enhance your stability. I'm available for individual or couples counseling, life skills mentorship, child loss grief support, LGBTQ+ support. I can also officiate weddings, end-of-life ceremonies, baby namings, invocations, or whatever guidance you may need. I serve all genders, all ages. Sessions are affordable, discreet, private, and conducted online. Find me at guy-wire.org.
Book your appointment today. That's right. You know, I'm a theater artist, and for about 10 years, a year after Cameron passed, I moved to Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is about 50 miles north of Boston.
Yep.
I was looking for my place, you know, yeah. I was feeling like a lost traveler.
Yeah.
And I landed in Gloucester, Mass, and was embraced by the community. I started a folkloric theater company to preserve and protect the stories of that place. And we really formed a family and a community around this theater. And opening night, before every show, we would stand in a circle and thank Cameron for having left when he was meant to, because if he hadn't, that the Folklore Theater Company would not exist. We would not be having this shared experience. You and I would not be sharing in this conversation if Cameron weren't conspiring somewhere out there.
No, I wouldn't be thinking about coming to Spain next summer if it wasn't for those two.
That's right. Well, I have a lovely guest room waiting anytime. And it also inspired you to write your book, which I've been exploring, 100 Acts of Love, The Girlfriend's Guide to Loving Your Friend Through Cancer or Loss. What a beautiful expression, what a beautiful gesture, and something that we don't talk enough about in the life skills world.
We don't. And I think, you know, it was something that I realized. I wrote it because I particularly wrote it for myself so I could remember what to say, what to do, and what all the simple little things, because I knew my memory, you know, I'm not going to remember this 20 years down the line. But I really wrote it for everybody else, because what I saw when Art was sick and after he died was I'm sure you had the same experience. There were people who knew exactly what to say and what to do. And they touched my heart, and they touched the hearts of my children and of my husband when he was alive. But there were so many more who didn't have a clue. And some of them had the courage, because honestly, helping people like us takes courage. We think, you should be able to do it. No, it takes courage. So some of them had the courage to try it, would get it wrong and try again. And other people wouldn't have the courage and would kind of, you know, chicken out. And I could feel how heavy it was in their heart to see me and to be reminded that they didn't do anything. And so I really wanted to help those. Now, it took me a while to get here. For a long time after my husband was dead, I was pissed. I was like, my husband died and you couldn't find the courage to come in here and just say something nice to me? Like, I can't deal with you. I don't want you in my life. You know, there's that resentment. But then after a while, I began to see it from the other side. And I also remembered that I was that person. I never knew what to do or what to say. I always felt like my words weren't enough. So that's why I wrote that book. I wanted people to really embrace how much they matter and how they didn't have to show up in these extravagant ways to show how much to tell the person they mattered, right? So when I thought about helping before Art was sick, I used to think, well, I'd love to offer to cook, but I'm not a good cook and I feel really bad and I can't cook 5 meals a day for them. And so in my head, I had the fact that I had to bring them a meal every single Monday for the next 9 months and commit to that. And it was too much. Wow. What I realized is somebody calling me while they're at the grocery store and saying, open up your cabinet and tell me what 5 things are you almost out of right now? I'm not going to stay. I'm going to pick them up for you. I'm going to drop them off at your door and then I'm out. Like, that's such a simple thing to do. It takes maybe, depending on where you live, maybe 15 minutes out of your way to drop off the groceries. Okay. You're not committing to having a conversation with them because you're giving them the out of maybe they don't want to have a conversation. So you just know that they need something. And honestly, all of us are always almost out of something. So, you know, I understood how simple those little things are. And that's what I wanted. That's why I put it in the book. It's get a gas card, take the car for a wash, call and take the kids to lunch. The gas card, right? Right? Take the kids to lunch. Tell them you're picking up the kids after school and you're not bringing them back till 9, 10 or that night. Take them to dinner and to a movie. It's if you're at work, bring them a hot cup of coffee. Find out what kind of coffee they want. Here's a hot cup of coffee for me. Lean in and go, so what stupid thing did someone say to you last week? Right? Like, get in there with them, because in the end, what you and I wanted, what every caregiver wants, what every person in this world wants, is we want to be witnessed. We don't want necessarily, yes, I'd love for people to come fix things for me, but in the end, what I really want is for you, Henry, to say to me, I see you, I see your pain, and I'm really sorry about it, yeah. Right? Just acknowledge it. And so the tips that I have in there are really these kind of simple ways to show up, practical things that really help. And I hope that people use it. I mean, I know that people use it as a springboard. They're like, I can't do this, but I can do, like, once someone gives them permission to really think outside the box and think about simple things to do, people's brains go wild and they come up with all these really helpful ways to show up. And, you know, my book's just the springboard and that's it. So that's why I wrote that.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Thank you for doing it, because it's much needed. There are so many people out there who want to help and don't know how, but there are also many caregivers out there who, one of the hardest things for me when I was living in the hospital with Cameron was somebody to call me or to show up and say, what do you need?
Yeah.
I don't know what I need. Just imagine yourself in my situation and just do it.
Yep.
Just do it. You might need.
The very first chapter in my book, I literally say, if you read nothing else, if you take nothing else from this book, take this. And it is, don't say, if you need anything, let me know. And there are three specific reasons that it's not helpful. The first one is what I just talked about, the connecting. It doesn't connect you with the person. Even when you say it with a great amount of intention, you're not seeing what they're, you're moving directly into action. And really what I always talk about is it's speaking, then feeling your feelings, assessing, and then going into action, right? Because most people go into action sometimes immediately and it's not helpful. So the first thing is you're not acknowledging the what's happening. The second thing is exactly what you said. What is anything? Like anything for you is very different from anything for me. I mean, I had a toddler. Did anything meant you're going to take your brand new, just detailed BMW up to the preschool to pick up my snot-nosed vomiting toddler? Or did you mean that you just wanted to drop off a bottle of wine? And even in the moment when we mean anything, like in that moment, if you said to me, Kim, I need you to go to Alaska and get me this special kind of caviar, I'd be like, yes, yeah. I'm gonna do that. And then I'd leave and go, I can't do that. I have a job. How am I going to pay for this? I don't know where, you know, like all the questions would come up. So in the moment, we mean anything, but we really don't mean anything. The third reason it's not helpful is exactly what you said also. You just put the pressure on the person whose life is upside down, sideways, already like they're walking on a wall. Yeah, exactly. Who doesn't know anything. Like they may look, especially the caregivers, they may look like they're dealing with 52 cards in the deck, but they do not have 52 cards in the deck. So you're asking them to take apart their day and to find one thing that they can do for you. And I can't remember, I can't remember what I ate for dinner last night, but I can because I went out to dinner. But I certainly can't remember what I ate for dinner on Tuesday. And if I think about it, I can remember what I did this morning because I have a routine. But, you know, other than that, I can't tell you. And then the last reason, which to me sometimes is the most important reason, is most of us, and I include Western European countries as well, Western countries as well. And actually, I'm going to include some other nations as well, because I've had this conversation with people who live in China and who live in Nigeria, is that most of us are not good at asking for help. We don't like to ask for help under good circumstances. So why on earth would you ask someone who is like just a raw nerve to come to you and ask for help? And then wait for you to say, oh gosh, can we do it tomorrow? Like, there's no way I'm going to ask you for help in my vulnerable state and risk being rejected. I cannot handle that.
For years, I've turned on the television and the internet and have felt bombarded with messages of support, begging for money to support children in Africa, Afghanistan, India, all over the world, war-torn countries, children are starving, not only for food, but for education and love in some cases. I recently connected with Desire Childcare Organization that transforms the lives of orphans and vulnerable Ugandan children in Kampala and Mukono by providing wholesome food, housing, healthcare, and creative arts education from early childhood to adulthood. Won't you join me in helping save orphans and vulnerable children? We can do it together, one organization at a time. I chose this one. Visit desirechildcare.org for more information. Thank you.
I can't handle it.
And anything that you need in that moment that you can't have any kind of clarity to express, you may not need in the next moment. It's right now. This is how I feel. This is what I need. And unless you are a magic genie that can blink their eyes and make something appear, which most people are not, it makes it really tough. There's also the guilt and the shame attached to not only being a caregiver asking for care, but also in the, as you say, the asking for help. There's such a stigma, especially in the West, especially in America, but also places like England. You know, I've spent time in Europe. I've been here for the last 5 years. And I see the same things everywhere, that there is.
It's the same thing.
I don't see it in Spain. When somebody shows up at your door, if somebody passes on, say it's your partner, a gaggle of women will show up.
Right.
Cleaning pails and buckets of food.
It's
an expectation that your community will rile around you.
Right.
My experience of living in the hospital with Cameron, we were very lucky. And I count my blessings every day. We were very lucky to be treated in the place where we lived.
Yeah.
That makes the experience uniquely better.
Absolutely.
Automatically.
Absolutely.
Because you have friends at your elbow. You have family. Be right there.
Yep.
But we met so many people in the hospital who were far, far from their home communities and had nothing, had nobody to bring them. You know, you show up, I don't know how many days or weeks you spent in the hospital with your husband, Art, but I remember looking down at my hands thinking, I haven't clipped my nails in 2 months.
Right.
I don't have nail clippers.
Right.
Right? Or clean clothes, or God forbid, you know, you have a way of eating that is either religious or personal, the hospital's not going to accommodate the caregiver. They're there to take care of their patients, not their patients' carers. And so you said earlier about the sometimes seemingly stupid things that come out of people's mouths around. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I dealt with the resentment and the anger. How can you not hear what just came out of your mouth?
So I look at it this way. One of the reasons people look, death, cancer, anything that is a possibility of knocking us off in this mortal coil scares us. We're not, you know, and by we, again, I mean, mostly the Western culture, we're not really good at facing the idea that we are going to die, and that we are not going to be here forever. And that fear plays a key role in our ability or lack of ability to connect with someone who's going through a tough time. So I have a kind of a, when I work with clients in the corporate world, or like I work with managers and helping them understand how to be compassionate and productive, how to drive compassion and productivity in their team when they're dealing with an employee who's dealing with cancer, loss, or depression. So I have a strategy called the North Star strategy. And the first thing I tell managers to do is just speak. Like, look, you're going to get it wrong, probably most of you, but it's better that you say something than nothing at all. The second thing I have them do is feel. And that's the key to saying something that's heartfelt. Compassion. Most of us are terrified to feel. I don't want to feel like, you know, Henry, honestly, I'm probably going to get off this call and cry because your son died. Like, that just breaks my heart. You know, and so the feeling it when your employee, when your friend, when your sister, when your mother, when someone you care about gets a diagnosis of cancer or something that's going to take them off this earth, no matter what you do, it's a horrible feeling. There's so much sadness. And sadness is one of those emotions that you can't fix. You have to walk through.
That's right.
And so there's no, happiness is not the opposite of sadness. Happiness it's not the answer to it. And so what it is you have to walk through sadness. You know, you can fix resentment. You can work through, you know, anger, which is actually a cover emotion for all the other emotions that go underneath that, but you can't fix sadness. You can't change it. There's only going through it. And so that makes a lot of people uncomfortable, right? And sometimes we don't know where that sadness comes from. We're like, we don't know the coworker very well, and we're really upset that they have cancer. I'm like, what? I don't even know him. Like,
it's hard enough with your friends and your family. Exactly. How many people, you know, how many people I ghosted me after my son passed? You know how many lifelong friends?
Yes. Yes.
Oof, yes. Vanished into thin air.
Yes.
My confidant.
Yes. Henry, I'm with you.
Yep. Some of them just went.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't handle their own grief around
exactly.
me. And if they touched me, I'd burst into a million pieces, and then they'd have to pick you up.
Right, exactly. And the thing is, they don't have to pick you up. They just have to hold that space for you to allow you to crumble, and you'll pick yourself up. You're ready, you lift your head up, you put your hand, they don't know that. So that's the feeling piece. The other thing I have people do is walk through their stereotypes, because we all have stereotypes about what it means to have cancer, about what it means to be a caregiver, about what it means to have a child that's died or a spouse that's died. We have all these stereotypes in our head, and we tend to not examine them. And then we act based on those stereotypes. So I'm sure you hear this all the time, but you know, I'll tell someone that my husband died and they're like, oh, how are you? And I'm like, girl, it's been 13 years. Like, I think about him every day, but people who haven't dealt with loss think about him in a sad way every day. That's people who have been through loss know that when I think about him every day, it's smile, it's cheerful, it's knowing I was loved fiercely for 14 years of a marriage, right? It's the good part that I think about. But if you don't know this, you have the stereotype and then you base your responses on it. So that's why I think people often say the wrong thing, is because they haven't managed and looked at their own emotions around what is happening to this person that you know, don't know, feel for, don't feel for, whatever it is. And until you, like all emotions, they leak out of us. We think that we're covering. Look, they just did a study that showed they did parents, and they have parents put them in a scenario where they were really agitated. And then they said to come play with their children. The kid knew that something was wrong. This is a 3-year-old, knew that something was wrong, was having a hard time engaging, and then felt like disengaged, and then eventually disengaged from the parent. For us to even believe, I get really frustrated with this, for us to even believe that that we can tamp down our emotions and they don't leak out of us is pure insanity. Yeah. So whatever you feel towards this person about their cancer or about their being a caregiver is going to leak out of you onto them. So for heaven's sake, do us all a favor and feel your feelings, write it, talk to another friend, cry. If you need to watch a sad movie to make yourself cry, Fault in Our Stars is a great movie to make yourself cry, right? They did another one recently with Zoe Saldana, where her husband dies from cancer. He's like a cook, and you know, so do that. You know, if you need something to make you cry to get out of your system, do it, because whatever you feel is going to leak out on people. And that's how we make our decisions. We do not make decisions in the rational way we think. They are all based on our emotions and feelings about things. Okay, I'm done with my little tirade. I'm sorry, but that's something brilliant. I really feel it's super passionate about.
Well, and we become passionate about it. And it does change when you have a close loss like this, your partner or your child. It changes you for the rest of your life. And for me, as I expect for you, I feel that there's a difference between mourning and grieving. I believe that mourning is a temporary state.
Mm-hmm.
Grief is forever. And the grief is a noun. the grief. Ooh. You can hold it. You can touch it. It's a personal thing that you can manage. You can channel your grief into service, as you've done with the book, as I've done with the Lost Travelers Club. You know, there are ways to channel your grief.
Your generous sponsorship and individual support of the Lost Traveler podcast benefits the Lost Travelers Club, a charitable project under the fiscal sponsorship of United Charitable, a nonprofit 501c3 organization. The Lost Travelers Club focuses primarily on the needs of parents who have outlived their beloved children. We recently launched our new Brain Candy Project Wing, providing art supplies to children still struggling with critical or terminal health-related conditions. We hope to raise enough funds to launch Brain Candy, an arts and literature magazine created by and for these young people. Find out more at www.braincandy.online. Thank you. Shadow and Light, LLC was established by Dave Roberts and Reverend Patty Farino, co-authors of When the Psychology Professor Met the Minister. Their mission is to empower individuals to transcend life challenges by integrating spiritual practices with psychology to achieve peace. They are available for individualized spiritual counseling, virtual or in-person presentations and workshops to universities, organizations, and other interested groups, virtual or in-person book club meetings. For further information, go to psychologyprofessorandminister.com.
And I think the other thing too is I'm fully aware that my grandchildren will grieve for the loss of my husband because it's going to be carried down through my children and through me. Right. We're all, whenever that baby arrives, not that there's nothing on the horizon, but hello, children, just in case you're thinking about it, I'm okay with that in the next couple of years. So, you know, whenever that baby arrives, there's going to be grief around that child because their father, their grandfather, the person who was supposed to be there, who we knew would have made a great grandfather, is not going to be there. And so that child will carry, and I want to really make sure your listeners know that's not a bad thing, right? I tell my children all the time, and it happens all the time with them, they meet other people with the same cracked hearts. Yeah. And it happened to me just the other night. I was playing poker, a monthly poker group I play with. There was a new person there. I just really liked her. And I thought it was because of her name. And she reminded me of someone I knew in high school. Turns out, guess who lost a child at 4 months and then another one at age 36.
Yeah.
So there was just this feeling like I just knew that there was something deeper with her. When we connected, it was like, oh.
There's a frequency, a matching frequency
is,
that we carry. And we can cultivate our sensitivity to that. We have many more senses than just the five that we're taught. Right?
Yes.
We have a sense of beauty. We have a sense of danger. We have a sense of foreboding. We have a sense of excitement, right? There are all these other things. And I feel when I meet other people who have walked this road
of
caregiving, of somebody close to them, I feel an instant camaraderie. We could compare notes for probably 3 hours. For me, it wasn't so much people's lack of ability to relate or cry. Whenever I would go to the co-op, somebody would run up to me with puppy dog eyes and fall apart.
Apart
in my arm. They were dealing with their own grief around.
Yep. They were trying to get you to comfort them for the grief that they were feeling about your loss.
It drove me out of town. I took a 2-week road trip to the Grand Canyon. Yes. I needed to feel small again after caregiving years and being a superhero. I had to feel my smallness. I had to get my scale back.
Yep.
And
yeah,
it was crazy. I met a I think she was Zuni. tribeswoman, and she was selling the jewelry that she had made. And I asked her if I could sit with her for a moment and ask her a question. And she invited me to sit down. She was what you would imagine, long silver hair, little slit eyes, very wrinkled and
right.
You know, she was Mother Earth. She was all the elements wrapped up in one.
Right.
And I said, I just lost my son a few months ago, and I'm having a bit of an existential crisis because I don't know how to refer to myself anymore. As you know, when you're a parent, that is the expression of your identity. Every house you live in, every work you do, every roll of toilet paper that you buy, you're thinking about your child first. And that identity was plucked out of the equation for me. He was my only child. So, and I was a single dad on top of that, right? So, so I said, I cannot find a word like widow or orphan that I can lean on.
Yeah.
To describe who I am now. Is there anything in your culture or language that holds this?
Yep.
And she paused for a moment. And she said, you know, I think maybe the reason you haven't found a word is because it's too profound a loss for a mere word to describe. She said, in my culture, your name would change because your name is the expression of your identity. And when you have lost your child,
you change
your identity.
I love that.
I know. I was like, so, and she said, I might refer to you then as Henry, whose son is gone. That becomes your new name. And I introduce you to people who don't know you that way as Henry, whose son is
gone.
When we're talking about you and you're not in the room. Oh, I saw Henry gone today. Even when you're not and no one else is around, someone's thinking of you, they think of you with your own, with your name. So that
I love that
they are holding you, whether they are meeting you or thinking about you or loving you. That's the 101st act of love is to hold you in your grief that way. And I didn't feel like it fit quite into the global lexicon. I don't expect to walk around and myself, hello, my name is Henry, whose son is gone. So I hyphenated my first name with his.
I see that, and it's brilliant. I mean, I love that idea. So it's funny because I think you probably felt the same way. I wish that we had gone back to the time where we wore black bands just to show that we were mourning, because there were so many times I wanted to slap on a black band just out in public, like hurting unit here, and then we could see other people who were hurting too, and we'd be like, oh, gotcha, babe, or just randomly hug that stranger who's wearing that black band in the store, because we get it.
I was raised Jewish, and you actually tear your clothing when you're
mourning. Tear your clothing.
Exactly.
But it wasn't, you know, I needed longer than that. You know, I needed to, I'm not Jewish, and we sat Shiva because I really wanted to have that moment of like, y'all, this is really serious. Like, this isn't kind of like, let me doll up and everything. Like, this is, this thing happened to me and I need to physically express it some way. Yeah. And I think that's one of the problems we don't have anymore in our culture is that ability to do that.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. I'm Queen Bee Divine. The cure is conversation. And where can you find me? At BluntReflections.com, where I will be talking to guests from around the world that not only share their time, but their insights and their tips on how they became the best version of who they were meant to be. So if you're looking for a great story and a great time, check me out at BluntReflections.com. The cure is conversation. And remember, blasé, blasé means to tell your story.
But I'm still toying with a tattoo, and I'm going to get tattooed the longitude and latitude of where he died, which is in the hospital at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. And, you know, someone said, well, why don't you get the birth and the death? And I'm like, no, because everything in my life, you delineate your life between before he was dead and that's after right. he died. It's right. And then I remember thinking, wait, did that happen before? That, you know, you get far enough away that you have trouble just figuring out, did that happen before or after? And you're trying to figure that one. Then you have to go to dates. You're like, oh, that happened at the beginning of 2009. That's right. Okay, so that meant that it happened before he died, or happened late 2009. So that meant it happened after. Yeah. So yeah, I feel that. And I think that people, like, I understand why people ran away. Yes. I really do.
Yes.
And it took me some time to get there, but I now understand why people ran away. And trust me, I just found out that a friend of mine's husband died, and all I want to do is get her through. Like, I'll take your pain. I will take all that grief on, because I know how to work. I know how it works.
That's right? Our measure.
I will take all that grief on, and I'll hand it back to you at 2.5 years. So it doesn't hurt as much. 2.5 years feels like that was farther away that the acute loss started to lose its pointedness. Mm. Right. And the other thing too is, you know, we have similar cracked hearts, but you have more in common with the woman that I met. Right. You have more in common with my in-laws, who also struggle with, wow, how do we say how many kids we have? Because the next question is, where are they? What are they doing? And then my mother-in-law has to say, well, my oldest son died.
Exactly.
And then she has, and for anyone who's listening who has not dealt with a loss, please, like, when someone shares with you their loss story, don't do the, I thought you were going to say this before, the big puppy-eyed, arm on the hand on the arm.
How are you? Exactly.
And you know, I am perfectly fine with the question of, how are you dealing with that today? Yeah. Or in this moment? And I can say, you know, today was a good day. And actually, now that I'm talking about it, and now that you've actually connected with me on this level, I actually want to cry.
Yeah.
Because I see in your eyes, I'm going to cry right now. I see in your eyes how you get the devastation.
Yeah.
So when you connect with someone on that heart level who gets the devastation, whether they've been through it or not, but it slows down enough to go, how are you this moment? Yeah. And sometimes I'm like, you know, it's been 13 years. I'm great.
I'm doing okay.
It's been 13 years, 9 months and 27 days. I'm good. You know?
Right.
So yeah. I think it, you know, so whatever you do, when you say, I mean, I tell people, instead of saying, if you need anything, let me know, to get into your heart and say how sorry you are. And a great phrase I love when people say this to me is this, I just don't know what to say.
Yes.
Because that really demonstrates the level of the loss. It's so profound that it leaves you speechless. And so you say, I don't know what to say. Love it.
And it's enough of it. It gives them permission.
Yes.
It gives the caregiver or the person who's experienced the loss permission to say, it's okay, you don't have to say anything. It's just that you
said exactly.
Permission is a powerful thing.
Exactly. And then get specific about how you want to help and offer more than once. You know, the book is dedicated to a guy named Kinney in the Venice Farmers Market here in Los Angeles, because when I told him that my husband was sick, he said, if you need anything heavy moved, let me know. And he would offer that quite a few times. And I just thought it was the weirdest offer. I was like, well, you know, but it stuck in my head. I always remembered. And after he died, we had a grand piano. And who do you think I called when I decided I was going to rearrange the living room? Wow. Right. So offer something that you know you can do. Keep it simple and offer more than once, because as you said before, that person you're offering to is not dealing with a full deck of cards. Yeah. And they're going to forget. And when you offer more than once, you're giving them permission two things. You're giving them permission to ask for what it is you offer. Like, it's safe now. You've offered it more than once. They know you really mean it. So it's safe for them to ask. The other thing is, sometimes you're actually giving them the space to ask for something else that you'd be willing to do. Right. So you're giving them the permission to come to you and not have these random, but you're provided a safe space. You can say, thank you so much for like offering to wash the car, but I really need gas. Is there any way that you can come by? I'll give you the keys. I'll give you my credit card. Can you just fill my car with gas? I can't go out today.
For me, it was paying for the parking bill at the
hospital. Yes. At the hospital. Yes. Yes.
I started a after I started the foundation with Cameron, the first thing that we did was to provide parking for parents who were living in hospitals.
Yes.
For real kids.
Yes.
Because many of these families were far from home. They had no other option but to park at the hospital. And until we solved the problem of somebody making a buck off of other people's misfortune, we're going to pay it. We started an endowment in my son's name that is perpetuity
brilliant.
At the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis.
Balance, pain mitigation, range of motion, athletic performance, focus, memory, immune system support, and REM level of sleep, all this and more made possible affordably with no pharmaceuticals, no injections, or invasive treatments. Just socks, insoles, and patches made stronger with the tactile patterning of Vox Life products. Scientifically proven to work and guaranteed. Now in the USA, Canada, and the UK. Visit www.dianedinkmeyer.voxlife.com. That's Vox, V-O-X-X, Life. You'll be glad you did.
Parking was a big, I remember one of the parents had some connection at the hospital and they gave us these little stamps so that we could get free parking and put on the parking pass. And then another parent did. She literally dropped off $1,000 in my mailbox one day, specifically for parking. She said, you know, just take it, use it.
The world doesn't stop. You still get your bills. You have pets at home that need care that can't be with you in the hospital.
Yep.
Or, you know, somebody brought me an air mattress because I've been sleeping on that Fred Flintstone chair.
Right. Yeah.
Getting the rest that I needed to take the best care of my son. And so that little gesture, I thought you might benefit from this here.
Yep.
It inflated in 8 seconds, deflated in 5 seconds. The oncology team came in. I could roll it up and stow it and not have, it was game changing. Things like that you can't think of, nail clippers or air mattress in the moment. You just can't think of that. And the worst thing to say to somebody who's experienced a loss, for me, that was the hardest thing for me to swallow, was when somebody came up, they put their hand on your arm and they said, I know exactly how you feel. I just lost my parakeet last week and it's it devastated me. Right. Yep. And my parakeet was like my child.
My child.
My son. What do you say? I am so sorry for your loss, but that was a hard one for me to, you know, equate. But then you take a half step back, you say, at least they're making an effort to relate. And they, if they knew better, they would do better. They didn't have
Exactly. And I think that's the thing. I think it's just, it's grace. And sometimes you have a lot of it to give and sometimes you don't. And I think either way, as a caregiver, you know, you have to give yourself grace. Sometimes you're going to react and be like, you know what? That was the dumbest thing you could have said. That's very hurtful. Like, here's a book you need to go buy the book and come back. Right. Yeah. Or sometimes you just kind of smile and nod your head and you take it because you get that they don't understand it. But I think the thing that I was very conscious of was making sure, and you touched upon this a little bit, PTSD, is making sure that we don't internalize it. Because for me, I internalize a lot of that. So I would just get so rageful and so angry that somebody couldn't take the time to figure out what to say. So it took me some time to, because it was so hurtful. And then, so I needed to take that time to really do that digging and look at it from their point of view and even take the word at least out, but just say they did the best they could, you know, at the time. And I probably said the exact same thing. I mean, I very much believe what really bugs you in somebody else is the thing that you hate the most in yourself.
Exactly.
And so I realized I've said that to somebody before. I don't know when, I don't know. I can't remember. I wish I could, because I would go make amends to that person immediately, but to really have that patience, but it takes some time, you know, and sometimes your best defense is anger.
one of those life skills that we don't teach, you know, that we don't talk about. And the reason I started this podcast, we have 35 countries now listening. Wow. So all around the world, people are resonating with something that we're doing here. And when we talk about life skills, we're talking about those essential universal skills that every human being on the planet learns.
Right.
Grief is one of them.
Yeah.
Loss, handling, navigating loss is another one. Often not taught at home, not taught in school, not talked about. And so I feel very, very grateful and privileged that you are coming to the table, not only with your expertise firsthand, but also with your book that offers, as you say, a springboard of inspiration, because every one of those 100 acts of love can inspire you to say, oh, wait, you know, I could do that too. Like you can make it a million acts of love.
And really what I want people to know is, in when our friend is in crisis, we often feel small. Yeah. We feel like there's nothing we can do. We're powerless. We don't have the cure for whatever cancer they're going through. We don't have money to give it. Like, but what you do, you're not powerless. You're not as small as you think. And, you know, I'm not here because I'm actually here because I built a foundation on the support of all the people, all the things that people did for us. Every single time someone showed up, it really mattered. And it didn't matter how small it was. It was the act of showing up that mattered the most. And I think that's what I want people to really know. There's no right way to show up. The best thing you can do is just show up. That's really the key.
Yeah.
So
there's no right way to grieve. Really, there's no right way to mourn.
Exactly.
You know, we are all navigating. We are all lost travelers on
navigating.
This journey.
Yep.
And that's how we come together. Now, normally at the end of an episode, I'll ask my co-host to share three practical tools, but you've shared so many more than so I'm going to ask you, I have another, it's actually a talk show on YouTube. It's called Classic Screenshots. And we're talking about the history of classic film, especially in America, as being the foundations for culture and the way that we navigate the world today. We're finding the roots are in, even back to the silent era, things that are tied to our mental health today. We just watched this one from 1918 called The Blue Bird. And it was like a Wizard of Oz type story where it was a journey and you're looking for the bluebird of happiness. These two children, a fairy points them, you know, in the right direction.
Right.
Brilliant film. Everyone should see it with their kids. It doesn't matter how old your kids are. But the whole point of that story is about that search for elusive happiness. So I'm doing a bluebird segment now.
Okay.
To close out the episode. What is your bluebird?
My search for happiness, you mean, or what's the thing that makes me?
Well, what's the thing that you have searched for or are searching for that just you almost touch it and it flies away?
I don't know. So I'm going to answer it this way. One of the things that my husband and I thought were really important that we teach our kids to be resilient.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a really good idea on the first surface of the things, but it means as a parent that you need to let your children hurt. Yeah. You need to let them fall down. You need to let them feel the pain. You need to encourage them to stand up. You need to watch them wallow. It is one of the most painful things you can do as a parent is to teach your kids to be resilient. Yeah. I kind of treat contentment the same way. I chase contentment. I chase peace, right? Inner peace. But I can't have those things if I don't have the lack of contentment and the inner chaos. So I think that, you know, when I sit in those moments of being, I want more moments of contentment, knowing that they will never, ever, I will never be able to be 100% content all the time. So I think that those are the moments where I just, you know, my three kids are going to be here for Christmas. And even though I'm going to be having knee surgery, I am hiring a photographer and we are going to have pictures taken.
Yes.
And there's the reason I'm doing it is because I want to look back at that moment and feel that contentment, the contentment of having my three children together for Christmas and us being goofy and them making me laugh. I'm probably going to pee at my pants at some point. I'm probably going to have to go change my underwear at some point. And that's what I chase. That's what I chase, knowing that when I'm not there, it's actually a good sign because I'm either going away from it, which means I'm going to hit a bottom and come back up, yeah, or I'm coming towards it again. So I don't know if that answers the question, but I think
it does, you know, and you're right. It does happen. It comes to us in moments, in glimmers. And the whole message of this film, of the story, it was a play before it was the film, is that when you find those moments of contentment or happiness, when you found the bluebird, let it go and share it,
yes,
with someone else. Let someone else capture it for a moment.
I love that.
And you can take those moments and you can create bluebird moments for other people. So yes, I think we need a lot more of that messaging in our world right now.
I love that.
I want to thank you for this hour that you've shared with me from such a deep place.
Henry Cameron, it has been my pleasure, 100%.
I will make sure that listeners have access to your contact information in the description. Also a link to your book. It's available both via ebook and a paper book. So whatever your preference.
Mm-hmm. And the book title is also the title of my website, which is 100actsoflove.com. And so
and it's not just for girlfriends.
It's not just for girlfriends. Yep, I did that. But, you know, I'm going to have to redo that title for sure. But thank you so much, Henry Cameron, for your time. I really appreciate that. And I'm touched by your story. And thank you for everything that you're doing for all the caregivers, past, present, and future. Really appreciate you. Thank you
so much. Well, we will do this again, I hope.
I certainly hope so.
We'll do a part two. Thanks again. All the best. Okay. Happy holidays to you and yours.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to Season 3 of the Lost Traveler Podcast with your host, Henry Cameron Allen. Visit me online at www.henryallen.org. Thank you to all my guests, and thank you to my listeners all around the world. I couldn't do this without your support. Let's keep striving for a better world together.